without further ado, Robert.
Okay. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to come and speak with you today. How I became interested in the drink crisis in the First World War goes back to when I was studying at A-level history, and I had a lesson about the Dora legislation, and my teacher at the time said, oh, they affected the pubs. They closed the pubs early, and just as an 18-year-old, that kind of stuck with me, and as I kind of moved into my early 20s looking for a research topic, thought, perhaps I should revisit that. And here we are, too many years later. So, obviously, today I'm going to give you kind of an insight into what happened in Britain during the First World War in the relationship between government, the pub, the legislation that was interacted, kind of a kaleidoscope into everything that happened. Reflecting last night, I realised that I'd been researching the Central Control Board, which is the organisation that dealt with drink legislation for 6 years of my life, which is actually the length that the institution existed. So it was a very sad moment for me. So let's kick things off. So a journalist writing in 1916, in the midst of the First World War, on the subject of belligerents, neutrals and the drink problem, observed that the historian of the future who's concerned with the Great War is chiefly its contemporary social life will find some of its most wonderful phenomena centred around the drink problem. In my opinion, he wasn't wrong. A pint of beer in the First World War was a controversial thirst quencher. Attacked by temperance critics, whilst being the livelihood of those involved in the trade, drink was the subject of much acrimonious debate throughout the tumultuous years of 1914 to 1918. The war politicised the issue of drink and drinking, polarising society. For some, a liking for beer became symbolic of the nation's drift to defeat, whilst to others, it remained one of life's pleasures, a quiet respite from the strains of war at home. As shells fell in northern France, politicians argued about pints being pulled in Portsmouth. In 1915, industrial manufacturing could not keep up with the military requirements on the Western Front, and attention focused on how the home front was letting down soldiers on the front line. This disparity of sacrifice created a great deal of moral consternation. Attention swiftly focused on drinkers who continued to imbibe despite the seriousness of war. To some, drinking alcohol symbolised a questionable commitment to the war effort and a moral failure. Concern focused on what workers, women, soldiers and the young were consuming, and the management of leisure became an increasingly contentious issue. Stories of excess drinking filled the newspapers right from the outbreak of the conflict, crystallising pre-war worries about how much alcohol was being consumed. Politicians and social reformers believed that a drunken society was not capable of winning the war. Indeed, even Kaiser Wilhelm, in a typically charismatic interjection, had proclaimed at the dedication of the new Naval Academy at Mervurkin on the 21st of November 1910 that I know very well that the love of drink is an old heritage of the Germans. Henceforth, however, we must free ourselves in every direction from this evil self-discipline. The next war will require of you sound nerves. The nation which drinks the least alcohol will be the winner. Something had to be done if the war was not to be lost. Action had to be taken to cut drinking in Britain to ensure that Britain was efficient enough to win the war. Within the press, there was much criticism of those who continued to drink. In London, one frustrated observer wrote to the Secretary of the Admiralty, "I wish you could have seen the scene around a public house just around King's Cross Station today. There were scores of men, sailors and soldiers drinking. It was heartbreaking to see them fine fellows reeling about on the pavement with glasses in their hands. One man was violently sick on the curbstone. It was disgusting. Lots of girls and women were about also. The house was crowded to the doors. Can nothing be done to lessen the temptation to the men? Since the war began, this particular house has done a warring trade, and the scenes there are appalling. If some trusty, reliable official from the Admiralty could observe this place, surely something could be done to stop these sad sights." Social Darwinist anxieties determined that the most temperate nation would emerge victorious in war. Each communal shortcoming was seen in relation to necessary national sacrifice. Evidently, the nation, and particularly the government, was not doing enough, and Britain's seemingly lackadaisical attitude to drink control contrasted unfavourably to the rapid and efficient measures implemented both in Russia and France, which quickly gained widespread publicity and admiration. In Russia, swift action was taken to abolish the government vodka monopoly by the Tsar, who was described by the New Statesman as the biggest drunk shopkeeper in the world. This legislation resulted in the closure of 26,000 vodka shops. The Tsar was in a position to do so, as in Russia the production and sale of vodka had been under state control since the 6th of June 1894. One of the Russian government's main motivations was the rabid drunken degeneracy which had afflicted the country during the ill-fated Russo-Japanese War of 1905. This decision was thus legitimised in terms of improvements in industrial and military efficiency, social welfare, and by the potential for economic savings. One report taken from the... apologies for the bad pronunciation of presumably Russian, Novoye Vremra, suggests that the old women in the villages can hardly believe their eyes and ears, so changed are their menfolk. Not a hard word, not a row, but everywhere peace, kindness and industry. War is said to be hell, but this is like a foretaste of heaven. Within Britain, there was a universal acclamation for Russia's actions, which forced the nation to look at each individual and each community's respective contribution to the war effort. The Bishop of Manchester in November 1914 noted, "I've been profoundly impressed by the action taken in Russia. It seems to me that a public act of that kind calls upon other nations to think, and thinking to take right action." Politicians and the press were also keen to comment upon the positive benefits of Russian action. Lloyd George described it as a great act of national heroism and sacrifice. And here we have a cartoon taken from the Times newspaper, which obviously has a Russian soldier, a vodka bottle being kicked out of Russia, and in totally prohibiting the spirit traffic, Russia has already conquered a greater enemy than the Germans. Nevertheless, the true extent of the sobriety of the Russian people was debatable when considering reports that emerged concerning the alleged nature of Russian illicit distilling being carried out on a widespread scale. Moreover, the Russian government still allowed beer houses to be licensed for the sale of beer, with the proviso that wine or liquor were not permitted on the same premises. Russians were still drinking, but the prohibition of the national spirit sent a powerful message that national efficiency was compromised by drink. This implicit challenge to Britain was made all the more explicit upon consideration of the action taken by France to tame its alcoholic excess. Within France, there had been a long-term concern of the use of strong liquors, particularly the consumption of absinthe. For 50 years, absinthe had gained massive popularity among sections of the French population. With an alcoholic strength of between 47 and 72%, absinthe was an extremely potent drink, which temperance advocates pointed out had the potential for creating extreme harm, a trait which endeared to some, but generally caused much consternation within French society. Scare stories emerged concerning murders undertaken by absinthe fiends, which underlay moral concerns about the continued use of fiery intoxicants. A prohibition of absinthe bill swiftly emerged, which described absinthe as the internal enemy of France. By 1915, the Chamber of Deputies had quickly passed the measure, and the Senate ratified it successfully in March 1915. Further restrictions upon home distillation, increased tax on alcohol, and a state monopoly of commercial alcohol quickly followed. These decisions quickly found understandable favour amongst temperance advocates in Britain. Henry Carter, who was one of the most famous and notable temperance advocates, commented that France now realises to fight alcoholism as her national duty. Somewhat lost in the contemporary reaction to the Act was that steps to deal with absinthe did predate the war, but conflict acted as the catalyst for these measures to be implemented. Moreover, at the same time as absinthe was being barred, large supplies of wine were being ferried to the front, to the soldiers, in order to maintain morale. That Russia and France had acted on the drink issue, yet Britain had not, irked the sentimentalities of those in favour of action in Britain. Mar Murray proclaimed that other nations had chosen the path of victory, whilst we have thrown away the winning power of the war. Into that ditch where our great allies have flung their powers of weakness, we have flung our strength. In a ditch in France lies absinthe. In a ditch in Russia lies vodka. But beer and whiskey swagger through the streets of Britain. And in the ditch we fling the power of victory. We have a further series of a couple of cartoons again. So you have unemployed vodka, unemployed absinthe,
British booze move over. They obviously think that British booze is going to be the next victim of this kind of prohibitionist sentiment during the war. You also have, in many temperance journals, a propagandistic view of drink sellers who are, in one hand, are paying taxes, but in the other are feeding workers their alcohol liquor, and they have the child there saying, "What's he for, mother?" Business as usual for the alcohol seller, but what are the social consequences of selling alcohol during the war?
And finally,
this one. So, again, vodka and absinthe in turn, British beer. "Well, you know, you fellows are rather strong and dangerous. I'm a mild brute. Besides which, I'm doing my bit in contributions to the cause." So this was published by the Brewers' Gazette, a trade organisation during the war, who are obviously answering all of this sentiment that was apparent in the Times and in temperance journals. Paranoid about Britain's place in the world, campaigners presented the drink issue as being much more than a working man enjoying a pint in a pub, but as a symbolic totem of the decline of the British race. A moment of national reckoning had been reached, yet nothing was being done. The rejection or use of alcohol, it seems, had come to embody the cultural values of the nation. Some drinks companies, fearing association with the enemy, sought to reassure customers of their origins. One advertisement read, "Carlsberg Lager is not German, as someone with malicious intent is circulating. Carlsberg is brewed by the world-renowned Carlsberg Breweries at Copenhagen, Denmark, where only Danish labour is employed." Schweppes also vehemently denied that they were a German firm, whilst Perrier was described as the table water of the Allies, with a whiskey and Perrier cocktail described as a perfect entente. Another brewer placed the following advertisement, reminding readers that patriotism begins at home. So we'd love to see a British beer company, "Pledge your country in British, not German, lager." I live my life probably the other way around in terms of German lager, not British, but things change. In wartime, incidents which previously may have been ignored now became obvious examples of societal breakdown and provided the mentality for action to be taken on the drink question. As Sir Alfred Pierce argued, "To a nation at war, alcohol is a traitor. It is made by a wasteful expenditure and a much-needed food and labour. It lessens the physical fitness and power of the civil community. It blurs their judgment, lets loose their emotions, exposes them to greater risk than epidemic diseases, and it undermines their power to make good the serious ravages of war." A large proportion of news was devoted to reports about what was classed as deviant behaviour of the time and its consequences. During the early months of the war, Britain's streets were littered with soldiers about to be sent to war in France. On occasion, some of those troops were boisterous in attitude and lacking in sobriety. Looking back, it seems perfectly natural that these men would have wanted to savour their last hours of freedom before being sent off to war and likely death. To some, the best way to go about this was to get drunk. However, moral frameworks dictated that a soldier, if he was going to be of any use, should be sober. Insobriety equated to a breakdown in the military effectiveness and discipline of the army, which was an essential prerequisite of victory. The propagandistic portrayal of the sober British soldier, in contrast to the enemy, was compromised by drinking on the home front. The government was aware that drunken soldiers were proving problematic. In October 1914, Lord Kitchener had appealed for citizens to avoid treating servicemen to drink and give them every assistance in resisting the temptations which are often placed before them. In November 1914, Lord Roberts appealed to the civil population to stop treating soldiers to drinks. He said, "Thousands of young recruits are now collected together in various places and are having their work interfered with and their constitution undermined by being tempted to drink by a friendly but thoughtless public." Criticism often came from established moral authorities, be they religious institutions or investigative journalists, who were not averse to adopting the moral high ground. For example, the Bishop of Liverpool was critical of the city's relationship with alcohol at the time. "A few nights ago, I went off to see my two sons by the mail train. I saw there a sight which I will never forget. The departure platform of Lime Street Station was crowded from end to end. Here were three drunken soldiers with linked arms rolling up the platform to the train. Here were soldiers leaning against each other and supporting each other, trying to find their courage. Here were friends, themselves half intoxicated, seeing off half-drunken men whom they had been treating. The whole place was a pandemonium. There were drunken shouts, drunken songs, and a babble of conflicting sounds. An officer returning to the front, a complete stranger to me, turned to me and said, "What a disgusting sight. If these men were at the front, they would be shot at once. It was the saddest send-off I ever saw, and it was a scandal and a disgrace to a great city." The bishop saw the drunkenness as evocative of Liverpool's disregard of the sacrifices required in wartime Britain. For many soldiers, drink, though, was forced on them. One soldier on leave from Flanders told a correspondent at the Manchester Guardian, "I cannot put my head outside my own mother's door without having people, total strangers to me, pressing me to take drink. I'm sick of it for one, and glad my leave is short." His opinion did not matter, however, since the symbolic damage had already been done. It was the drunken minority which grabbed the headlines when a virtuous war between good and evil, and according to temperance mindset, between a sober and drunk, was being fought. The first step taken by government in response to this public outcry was the introduction of powers given to naval and military authorities to close licensed premises in or near a fortified place. This was given on the 12th of August 1914. On the 31st of August 1914, the Intoxicating Liquor Temporary Restriction Act was introduced, which gave licensing authorities the power to restrict pub opening hours. This generally meant earlier closing at 9 or 11pm instead of 12:30am. In the first 2 months after the enactment of this act, the hours of sale were curtailed in 259 out of 1,000 licensing districts in England and Wales. By the end of 1914, the order covered 427 licensing districts. Introduced to curb late-night drunkenness and inhibit the opportunity of the overconsumption of alcohol, this act was intended as a representation of the government's desire to crack down upon industrial drinking. Furthermore, civilians were not allowed in the restricted areas to buy drinks for members of the armed forces, as it was believed that much military drunkenness was caused by the generosity of misguided patriots. These areas tended to be areas of military and significance, be that ports, production sites. That was the kind of initial emphasis. And then as the kind of perceived problem grew, that came to be enacted across large swathes of the country. The government also sought to limit consumption of drink by making it more expensive through a war tax introduced on beer on the 18th of November 1914. This raised the duty per standard barrel from 7 shillings 9pence to 23 shillings, with further advances of 1 shilling to follow in April 1916 and April 1917. The immediate intention was to raise the retail price by half a penny per half pint, so as to encourage a drop in consumption. One slightly eccentric wine merchant in Soho saw positives in this tax rise, as he announced in the price list from the period, "I'm proud to think that the dusty thousands of bottlenecks which peered at me from the dimness of my old crypts, like guns from between the timbers of an oaken frigate, represent hundreds of gold pieces, or scores of tons of coal, or thousands of cartridges now at Britain's call in our hour of danger." Another cartoon, again published by the Brewers Gazette, latched upon this comment that by drinking British beer you're contributing to tax receipts. So then they produced obviously British beer, the link between the shells, beer was providing the silver bullets, and every shot tells. And here the quote by Lloyd George, there. "Every half a pint that a man drinks will be contributing to the carrying on of the war." As the war progressed, the drink problem became more contentious on the home front. The expenditure of shells and arms on an unprecedented scale increased pressure on Britain's industrial infrastructure. Armament firms were expected to produce 176 million rounds by the end of 1914, when their capacity was just 3 million. From the 25th of August 1914 to the 1st of October 1914, as many artillery pieces were ordered as during the previous 10 years. Adjusting to this demand for military hardware was a difficult task, and the type of war being fought accentuated the problem. Trench warfare dictated that high-calibre, high-explosive shells were needed in large numbers. Concerns were also raised in the Admiralty that it took three times as long now to get transports out as it did before the war, due principally to drink reducing the available labour. Britain's factories, while simultaneously having to deal with a large amount of its experienced workforce joining the army, could not cope with demand. The shell shortage at Neuve Chapelle and later problems at the Second Battle of Ypres were a manifestation of these difficulties and increased worries about the British Army's efficiency being let down by disorganisation on the home front. Blame had to be placed somewhere, and the industrial working class bore the brunt of accusations regarding degenerate behaviour. Lloyd George, in his speech on drinking in munitions factories at Bangor in Wales on the 28th of February 1914, drew attention to the disruptive effect drinking was having on the production of munitions. I hear of workmen in armament works who refuse to work a full week's work for the nation's need. What is the reason? Sometimes it is one thing, sometimes it is another. But let us be perfectly candid, it is mostly the lure of drink. They refuse to work full time, and when they return, their strength and efficiency are impaired by the way in which they have spent their leisure. And in a much quoted phrase, when you read anything about drink in the First World War, this phrase always comes up: drink is doing more damage in the war than all the German submarines put together. This speech coalesced all of the social costs of drinking and re-emphasised their effect upon the productivity of the nation in wartime. Reaching out to those less concerned by social welfare, but more concerned about victory in war, Lloyd George raised the stakes of the drink problem, magnifying its inextricable links with national efficiency. And here I have a cartoon which I think kind of illustrates this. Britain expects. You have the recruiting sergeant, kind of policeman that works there. Your king and country need you. At the bench or in the trench, and there's a chap who's spending his time in the parlour, the beer parlour. Not the ideal situation. His speech was a radical intensification of pre-war attitudes to drink. Lloyd George mined a well-established stream of anti-drink discontent and contextualised the issue within the parameters of wartime struggle. By creating a climate of opinion in which restrictive measures could be pursued, he set in motion the development of several policy initiatives aimed at containing drinking. Lloyd George employed no statistical support for his rhetorical description, but the lack of factual material is inconsequential, as his words confirmed latent but long-standing fears concerning the social habits of this section of the population. The speech fed into a number of well-mined stereotypes, most notably that the working class was unable to control themselves when it came to the consumption of alcohol. One contemporary author of the time wrote that the measures implemented to curtail drinking emerged simply because, as simply, some people could not be trusted. Others agreed with Lloyd George, but were slightly more blunt in their expression. After the Battle of Neuve Chapelle, Douglas Haig blamed the workers' fondness for drink for the shortcomings in industrial productivity. The best thing, in my opinion, he argued, is to punish some of the chief offenders. Take and shoot two or three of them, and the drink habit would cease, I feel sure. These sub-people don't care what the king or anyone else does. They mean to have their drink. Lord George's speech precipitated a fervent debate over the issue. His actions suggested he wanted a national conversation to take place. Thanks to his machinations, the Times reported that on all sides it was admitted that the drink question was one of the most pressing problems of the day. By April 12, 1915, Lloyd George had received over a quarter of a million letters on the subject. The power of the drink crisis is measured when one assesses who contributed to the debate. The King, who said that he would abstain from alcohol during the war, the media, Parliament, the Cabinet, high society, the church, the temperance movement, all of them had a say. The issue was contentious and one that needed a solution, yet it was difficult to do so since precise information on the nature of the problem had yet to be presented to the most important participants of all, the public. Seeking to dampen the popular hysteria, the Times declared, "The question of drink in connection with the production of war material is getting a little bit out of perspective. To magnify a single point until it assumes monstrous proportions and blocks out everything else is a certain road to failure. The problem is to increase the production of war material, but is in danger of disappearing from view in a cloud of controversial dust about the age-long subject of drink." Mr. Lloyd George's striking remark about fighting three enemies, of whom the worst is drink, may have led to certain confusion. It puts drink, which can only be fought in a metaphorical sense, on the same plane with the enemy, whom we are really fighting. This editorial reveals a crisis mentality now entrenched in the public mind. The problem was out of perspective, as essentially the shortage of shells was a manpower and management problem rather than a drink problem. this cartoon is from the Daily Mirror, and I just kind of think it indicates how drinking became the subject that everybody was talking about. I'm not going through them all, but is he, the child likes to be, surely be, he's not going to hurt anyone, they can't take our whiskey from us, I'm glad I've never got the habit of anything stronger than water, deeming I hope there is no alcohol in tea. The idea was that everyone was talking about drink, and it was a kind of a subject that kind of become a little bit out of scope with the kind of real emphasis on what people should have been concentrating on. So Lloyd George looked at prohibition, but that was never going to get through Parliament. Large swathes of the Conservative Party would never let it go through. He then talked about nationalising the drink trade, called state purchase. The cost of that ruled that out. He then proposed his third shot at solving the drink problem, which was to propose really, really extreme high taxes on alcohol and the creation of the Central Control Board. The high taxes themselves didn't get through Parliament. The only piece of the legislation that did was the fact that whiskey less than 3 years couldn't be sold. The idea being that would kind of reduce whiskey consumption, reduce the availability of whiskey. And from this legislation, the Central Control Board came into being. The Daily Mail doubted Lloyd George's ability to find an alternative and also questioned the rationale for his action. The Mail said, "We recognise Lloyd George's honest intentions throughout, but the truth seems to be that this drink question has become such an obsession with him that he is unable to see facts in their true proportion." Others were harsher. The Brewers' Gazette wrote that it is difficult to equal the muddle-headedness of this type of idiot to suggest that you can cure an appetite for drink by buying up the licences of publicans is like insisting that you will destroy a taste for beef by killing all of the butchers. The Central Control Board was created in May 1915. The board was established for the purpose of controlling the sale and supply of intoxicating liquor in naval, military, munitions or transport areas, where such control should be found expedient for the successful prosecution of the war. This was a historic moment for drink control in Britain. For the first time, a government body with real power had been established to deal explicitly with the question of alcohol consumption. The board was composed of an array of individuals from a variety of backgrounds. Lord Davenant, otherwise known as Edgar Vincent, was asked to chair the CCB and readily accepted. Aged 58, he already had an eventful career. Throughout his life, he had been a financier, a diplomat, a former Conservative MP, an unsuccessful Liberal candidate, and he had a good civil service administrative background, as demonstrated by his role as financial advisor to the Egyptian government from 1883 to 1889, and afterwards as governor of the Imperial Ottoman Bank at Constantinople until 1897. Coincidentally, after he left the CCB, he was also Britain's ambassador to Berlin during the 1920s, so he was quite involved in the Locarno Pact. Negotiations. So he's an interesting guy. Davenant was an imposing and in private charismatic figure. Margot Asquith described him as one of the four best looking men I ever saw. Here he is. This gives me hope. Davenant's beauty was an attribute that he apparently made good use of, with his extramarital affairs earning him the laudatory nickname the Piccadilly Stallion. Lloyd George's selection of Davenant as chairman of the board is unsurprising because he had a history of involvement in the drink question. He'd been a council member of the Surrey Public House Trust Company from its inauguration in 1901 and had served on the Home Counties Trust from 1909. These organisations were small kind of local organisations that looked at the pub and how they could make it more of a social space for working men rather than just at a drinking place. So they'd talk about introducing pub games, dart boards, food, etc. These organisations campaigned for pub reform and for changes in the goods offered for sale within drinking establishments in order to engineer reform within the individual customer. His expertise thus lay in a constructive and reformist aspect of public house reform. The necessity of required improvements in national efficiency gave Davenant the ideal opportunity to practice what he had preached. He was sure that the phenomenon of intemperance could be controlled by still skillful legislation, and he pursued this chance with some vigour. The board, at its conception, numbered 13 people. Expectations were high. The Scotsman described it as the largest social experiment of our time. The CCB met weekly and sought to regulate liquor sales in regions important to the war effort. Davenant admitted that he hoped to reduce drunkenness in the UK by 50% in 2 years. Other members of the board, perhaps the more notable ones, were Philip Snowden, the Labour MP, Neville Chamberlain was a member for a while, Henry Carter, who came from a temperance background, a chap called Waters Butler, who was the kind of leading brewer of the time. So he had a whole kind of collection of people who came to work on the CCB, who perhaps could turn experts of the industry, which kind of has parallels with what the government was looking at with its food legislation, etc. The board's policy was to take repressive measures initially in order to ensure that the act of drinking was made more difficult and drink, in some forms, less intoxicating. The sale or supply of intoxicating liquor for consumption on or off premises was restricted to 2.5 hours in the middle of the day and to 3, and in some cases 2 hours in the evening. These restrictions applied not only to pubs, but also to clubs, restaurants, grocers' shops, refreshment rooms, hotels and theatres. This was a massive reduction in opening hours, as pubs previously had been open normally from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. in most British towns, and from 5 a.m. till 12:30 a.m. in London. Off-sales were forbidden after 8 p.m. or 8:30 p.m. to limit the opportunity for continual drinking after the pub had closed. These changes meant that if an individual was to engage upon a long drinking session, he or she would, at the very least, have to be well organised. Public houses, however, were allowed to remain open in the curtailed hours for the purposes of serving non-alcoholic drink and food to encourage the growth of the concept of the pub as a place of general socialisation rather than simply being a place where alcoholic drink could be consumed. Furthermore, treating, the custom of buying drinks in rounds, was prohibited by the CCB, together with credited sales. The abolition of buying rounds was a major assault on working class custom. As I'm sure you know, it was the most popular way in which drinks were purchased. Balfour had originally raised the idea of banning rounds in March 1915 in Cabinet, with the caveat that these suggestions may perhaps seem at first somewhat fantastic, but they are, in my judgment, worth consideration. That he describes them as fantastic indicates the swift change in attitude that had occurred. What had once seemed like radical fantasy was now reality. One newspaper believed that the abolition of treating is perhaps the greatest revolution in our social customs produced by the war. The board not only meddled with behaviour within the confines of the public house, but also modified the alcoholic strength of the publican's wares. Spirits such as whisky, brandy and rum had to be dilated to 35 underproof instead of 25 underproof. The actions of the CCB illustrate the initial inclination towards repressive action. The year 1915 had witnessed a phenomenal alteration in the amount of control exerted upon both the drinker and drink itself. Although the actions of the CCB were not solely responsible for changes in drinking habits, a definite trend of declining drunkenness is evident. Drunkenness fell almost immediately after the board's measures had been introduced. In Liverpool, for example, the number of prosecutions for drunkenness fell from 240 per week to 164 after. In the North Coast region, there was a reduction from 201 arrests in the 4 weeks before the board's order to 107 in the 4 weeks after. Overall, drunkenness proceedings throughout the country dropped from 263,515 in 1914 to 205,345 in 1915, a reduction of approximately 58,000. Up to this point, nothing implemented had been truly revolutionary in content or what you might term progressive in nature, but had merely built upon the supposed truths of the preceding 18 months. The United Kingdom Alliance, which was a prohibitionist organisation, argued that the war had proven to be a rude but efficient teacher of temperance truth. So for the first few months of its existence, the board merely found its feet, implementing fairly conservative measures to limit drinking. As one reviewer stated, It will be a matter of surprise to many of our readers that those abuses of what is at all times a dangerous traffic should not long have been checked. However, the Brewer's Gazette anticipated more radical steps. We are interested spectators and anticipate lively happenings before the board is much older, it commented. And they were correct. Thoughts were turning to fundamentally changing the role of the public house, as the Daily Express speculated. When the war is over, hundreds of thousands of our men will return to this country with a knowledge never previously possessed of the possibilities of social life and intercourse possessed by reasonable cafe systems such as prevails on the continent. The sawdust and reeking atmosphere of the English public house will disgust them. They will resent the drink up and go attitude with which they will be met. They will be ready for the ideal public house. And here you have a cartoon which kind of illustrates that sentiment. The English, British system, I should say. Somebody goes in a pub, hammers back a drink. Whereas, presumably in Paris, on the continent, they kind of enjoy a leisurely drink in the parks, and it's just much more civilised in Europe. This was an optimistic appraisal. The CCB did have a significant power to implement such a radical change if it chose to do so. They obviously did a lot, and it's not within the realms of this paper to really discuss everything that they did, but perhaps the most radical thing that they did was they nationalised the entire drinks industry in Carlisle, so that everything, every aspect of it, pubs, nightclubs, everything came under the control of the government. The government produced its own beer, its own wine, its own vodka, so that no drink sellers had access to Carlisle, and it was basically a temperance experiment that took place up until the early 70s, actually, lasted after the war. This second thing that they did was look at kind of the relationship between food and alcohol consumption, and that's what I'm going to touch upon now. So the relationship between food and drink had always been a big debating point. The CCB, working in conjunction with the Ministry of Food, looked at how workers were fed during the war. So they introduced industrial canteens into factories. So that by kind of the end of the war, about 800 canteens had been opened by the CCB within factories throughout the country. They looked to implement, I guess, want of a better word, gastropub culture into Britain, because pubs really focused on the sale of drink because that was the most profitable for them. In total, the kind of canteen establishment accommodated close to 1 million workers out of a total of 2.2 million employed on munitions work. So it was a big social undertaking that they implemented. Beyond canteen provision, the board also implemented a series of other repressive measures. They banned the long pull, whereby licensees were prevented by law from being overgenerous in their measures of beer to attract custom. Some pubs used bigger glasses and gave more beer under the guise of it being a pint to try and get more people to come visit, and that was banned. The practice of canvassing of beer, where you'd have a door-to-door salesman who'd sell alcohol come to your house, that was banned. As to was credit drinking, so you couldn't buy drinks on the slate in a pub, and you always had to pay for the drink up front. Furthermore, the board was given the power to close pubs that did not abide by the board's regulations. By the end of the war, only 92 pubs in England and Wales and 86 pubs in Scotland were closed by the board. It's actually not that many when you consider how many pubs close per week in the UK currently. But in terms of the pubs that closed during the war, only 92 in England and Wales, so I thought that was quite a surprising statistic, and perhaps indicates how the pubs really followed the CCB's rules. These restrictive measures, however, were beginning to anger critics, who were angered by recent events and sceptical as to the motivation behind the board's ideas. Accusations that vindictive temperance activists were affecting the board's work were becoming increasingly vociferous. Criticism came from all sides, particularly as these measures had a sense of permanence which did not befit a supposedly temporary emergency body. The Globe assessed the work of the CCB and was distinctly unimpressed. We warned Lloyd George and the unconcerned and uncontrolled Lord Debenham that the people are becoming restless and dissatisfied. The city restrictions are a burden and an insult to the best community in the world, who have done nothing to deserve such a straight moral waistcoat. Some discontent with the board also emerged from Parliament. The Conservative MP James Mason complained that the board was attempting to set up during the war a complete system of temperance reform in a somewhat promiscuous and haphazard way. He further objected to this being done under the cloak of military necessity. Interestingly, the CCB had no direct representation in Parliament, so they were an extra parliamentary body. So whilst there were MPs on it, they were not held to account in any way in Parliament. That kind of contributed to their way in terms of which they were seen as kind of an arbitrary organisation. The board did have variable success in trying to distinguish itself as separate from the temperance movement. Some argue that it merely pandered to temperance principles. The trade was becoming increasingly angry. One official of the Edinburgh Trades Council, discussing the first actions of the board, opined that the order is simply fanatical and it is the work of temperance fanatics to further their own ends. So as an organisation, it was increasingly unpopular. But one of the most innovative things they did, and given where we are today, I thought it was perhaps going into a little bit of detail, was the scientific approach that they brought to alcohol consumption. So the CCB looked at how food scientifically affected the digestion of alcohol by the individual. So the general belief was that a full stomach made drunkenness less acute, but this had never actually been proven. In November 1916, the CCB sanctioned a pioneering scientific investigation to divulge the real effect of alcohol on the individual. This inquiry sought to demonstrate in physiological terms why alcohol was a danger to society. It was the first investigation of its kind ever conducted. Debenham, in a speech on the need for a scientific basis for temperance reform, given to the Church of England Temperance Society in mid-1917, articulated the reasons why the board was taking such a step. Practical information regarding the subject of alcohol has never been made the subject of research because there has been no proper recognition of the need of a scientific basis for temperance reform. This deficiency, I am glad to say, is now in process of being made good. Without a solid basis of scientific fact, temperance reform will be empirical and uncertain. The line of moderate regulation and reform has been advanced. In the preface to this report, Debenham was honest in his appraisal that there is an almost entire absence of reliable data regarding the psychology of the drunkard, though adequate information on this point is obviously essential to devising rational methods for the treatment of the inebriate. The work separated what is knowledge from what is surmise, conjecture, or popular belief. And by this primarily clarifying the question, prepares the way for further research. The unreformed elements of society, and a precursor to later, more malevolent experiments of the 20th century, were investigated and researched. During the course of investigations into the effect of alcohol, experiments were conducted on prisoners in Holloway Prison. In mid-1916, prisoners were made to consume various doses of alcohol and then attempt to use a typewriter to judge how much drink could be taken without affecting the effectiveness of the writing. Other experiments comparing the effect of alcohol on opium were also undertaken, together with tests on cats and dogs to understand the effect of alcohol. This report was published in book form in March 1918 to laudatory praise from the temperance movement. The book seemed to prove that excessive drinking was bad for health and thus bad for society as a whole. The report confirmed the physiological explanation for alcoholism, stating that the continued use of alcohol leads in many instances to changes in mental and bodily functions which create the need or craving for alcohol. Science had proven that too much drinking was harmful, but in line with moderate CCB thinking, according to the report, when administered in moderate doses, in dilute form and in sufficient intervals, alcohol has no effect of any serious and practical account. The Alliance News, which was a temperance journal during the war, noted, "This book is an honest attempt to state the truth as to the physiological action of alcohol without conscious bias in any direction. The report is not a temperance report. It is a report prepared by men of science, none of whom are total abstainers, so far as we know, after long and careful investigation, with a full sense of their responsibility to lay a plain statement before the nation." The report, in our opinion, makes out an overwhelming case for prohibition during the war and during demobilisation. The report exerted a proud influence over the drink debate. What had once been faith, that alcohol was just harmful, was now scientific fact. Much conjecture was now elevated to the status of fact. For example, the temperance movement had perpetually discussed the link between the proper provision of food and the avoidance of drunkenness. And this inquiry now proved that this was, that alcohol taken without food did endanger the stomach membrane. The board was predictably pleased with the contribution of this study. It said, "The authoritative character of this book, representing as it does the unanimous conclusions of the distinguished authorities serving on the committee, has been widely recognised, particularly by those who have a scientific or practical interest in alcohol and its effects. And the board believes that the book will exercise a marked influence upon future research, as well upon conduct and public opinion." The report justified the policy pursued by the CCB in that moderate drinking was shown to have a limited effect on national efficiency. It was far better to control drinking and effectively manage consumption rather than trying to pursue a radical programme of prohibition, which had neither the support of the CCB, politicians, the press, or the public. Moreover, prohibition was only supported by a small conglomeration of interest groups, notably elements of the temperance movement and the church. To argue that the drink policy implemented during the First World War was not radical ignores the extraneous political, cultural, and social circumstances which prevented prohibition being enacted. What was radical about the CCB was the fact that the board, with its blend of restrictive and constructive policy, managed to implement practical reform, like supporting the introduction of industrial canteens, which sought to resolve the drink crisis engulfing the country and cut through 80 years of antagonistic squabbling between the temperance movement and the trade. There wasn't much truth in the accusations made that Lord Davenant had merely implemented temperance reform under the guise of social reform in the interests of national efficiency. After the war, the distinction was not so important, but in the midst of conflict, it was necessary to deny such pro-temperance policies. His policies of reducing hours, banning the buying rounds, reducing the gravity of beers, reducing the strength of spirits, and the Carlisle scheme could have come straight from any one of the temperance journals prior to the war. These ideas were not innovative. It was the context of war which allows for their proliferation into mainstream politics. The emphasis placed upon industrial productivity and appropriate conceptions of leisure meant that these ideas were regarded as sensible in terms of national efficiency. Under the jurisdiction of the board, they proved their value in reducing sobriety. The unfortunate byproduct was that they became irrevocably associated with the CCB, which by the end of the war was a universally derided organisation. Really, it's coming to the end, so I'll quickly just kind of talk about the success that the board had in terms of the reduction. So the board's used convictions for drunkenness as the primary criterion for their legitimising its success. In 1915, this figure stood at 135,000, but by 1916, this figure had been reduced to 84,000, a reduction of 38%. This is the best indication of the board's work because after this, kind of reduction was placed upon the amount of alcohol that could be produced, and that obviously adds another variable into how you assess the impact of the board. But by the end of the war, I mean, alcohol consumption was 70% lower than it had been in 1914. As well as a reduction in drunkenness, the CCB could also claim there being less overall drinking. In 1914, the average number of bulk barrels consumed was 35 million. This had reduced to 21 million by 1918. For spirits, this figure stood at 31,000 gallons in 1914, 15,000 in 1918. In the longer term, a real shift in alcohol consumption patterns was precipitated by the war, as by the early 1920s, per capita consumption of spirits was half that of before the war, whilst beer consumption had fallen from 25 gallons to just 10. Taking into consideration that post-war beer was weaker in strength, this is indicative of a major change in social habits. This habit precipitated beneficial health results, with liver cirrhosis deaths reduced from 152 per million in 1914 to 56 per million in 1918, a reduction of 64%. The board could thus point to a reduction in arrests, a reduction in consumption of liquor, and to positive health benefits accrued as a result of its work. The situation was so favourable that the Chief Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Edward Henry, argued, "I believe that we have now reached a low watermark, and that no measure, not even a total prohibition, would be likely to bring about any appreciable reduction in the charges of drunkenness." The problem was that it was the CCB that had implemented this, and by 1921, you see from this cartoon, it emphasises that kind of the legislation introduced by the board was for wartime, but now it was peace, and people wanted the club rules and the landlord to really to take control of the pubs once more and get rid of the control board. Just wrap things off now. So the question remains, though, did a drink problem actually exist? The evidence is murky. Some reports from industrial centres highlight the problem of drunkenness, whereas others indicate that drinking did not hinder production whatsoever. In his parliamentary papers, Lloyd George actually physically underlined the reports that indicate there was a drink problem, but neglected to do the reports that argued that there wasn't. Anecdotal reports littered the printed press. Statistics are also inconclusive. Beer output fell by 35% from August to December 1914. So that's prior to all of the kind of actions that Russia and France had taken. And prices had risen heavily due to increased liquor duties and because of increased raw material costs. Monthly convictions for drunkenness had already started to fall. So in August 1914, there were 17,500 convictions. By March 1915, this had already fallen to 12. So the kind of facts don't really concur with kind of this effect of this belief that there was a drinking crisis. No genuine increase in drunkenness existed. Contrarily, we as historians can't wholly dispute the idea of the tales of rampant drunkenness that are to be found in so many sources from the period. If the drink problem did not exist statistically, it most definitely did in terms of being a social concern. The repercussions of war are many and varied. The drink debate during the First World War exemplifies how British society focused on unpatriotic social habits when the war was not going well. Someone had to be blamed, and the drinkers of the nation provided a suitable scapegoat. Drink had been a long-standing concern. The war merely presented an ideal opportunity for familiar arguments to be cast in a new light. The drink crisis that emerged stemmed from a desire to be seen to be doing everything to win the war, but the truth was, in fact, far simpler and more difficult for temperance activists to swallow. It did not really matter whether domestic Tommy drank, because the war was not won or lost in the pubs of Britain. The debate about British pubs was only one aspect of the British war effort. Victory was gained on the battlefield and throughout the factories of Britain. Victory celebrations took place in that most popular of British institutions, the public house, which will always have a certain allure. In the cold light of the post-war world, anxious war worries were less critical, as national efficiency had been tested and not found wanting to the challenges of war. Time had been called, and the protagonists of the drink crisis.